Remotes versus Republican Party of Nebraska. This is further argument on this case. Mr. Domina, good morning.
Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court. I'm Dave Domina. I'm here on behalf of Rex Motes. Your Honors, the First Amendment is not a pleading rule. And pleadings rules are not liar's tools. When Mr. Motes filed this case, his first paragraph in his complaint read in its first sentence, "False statements made for any purpose are abhorred by the law. Knowingly false statements made with actual malice or wanton disregard for the truth are defamatory." On that day, Mr. Motes knew of the United States Supreme Court's decision in Twombly versus Bell Atlantic. He did not know of the decision that would come down that year in Iqbal versus the Attorney General. He anticipated that this court would be working on pleadings issues, and you've now pronounced Doe versus Board of Regents. He understood that the pleading standard might become one requiring plausibility, and it now is one that tests his complaint against a plausibility standard. Mr. Motes wanted to plead and wants to try a case for defamation. So in his complaint, he carefully included the elements of proof. And he included the elements of proof of both defamation per se and defamation per quod. He did that by carefully outlining the fact that he could prove how the defendant operates, what it publishes, that its officers include lawyers who engage in practice in bankruptcy court, as he alleged in paragraph 18 of his complaint, and that the actual facts that would prove that the statements made against him were demonstrably or provably false, using your language in Wheeler versus Nebraska Bar Association, could be established by looking at that bankruptcy file, the file involving his employer, National Warranty. That specific and careful pleading was designed to assure that Mr. Motes could stay in court, even if plausibility became the pleading standard in Nebraska, which it now has. He believes that those allegations are sufficiently specific so that his pleading establishes on both per quod and per se theories that the statements made against him, and particularly those saying that he lied in an affidavit filed in court and thereby committed both a crime and a disbarrable offense, give him the right to present this case to a jury.
When you say that the publications state that he lied in an affidavit, to which publications are you referring?
3 and 4, Your Honor. Those are the two in your order for supplemental briefing and argument, and I'm focusing entirely and exclusively on that point, on those two.
Okay. And what, and do either of those use the word lied?
No. They say false, that his affidavit was false. Each of them says that. Each of them accuses him of a falsehood.
Is that by misleading?
Or? I'm sorry, does it say the word false? Does it say lie? Does it say misleading? Just getting kind of specific about the publications.
In connection with publication number 3 on page 7 of the complaint.
Right.
We quote the publication as saying, "How did Rex Motes mislead creditors and the public?"
Okay.
That's the question posed in the publication. The answer given in the publication is, Rex Motes claimed in an affidavit that National Warranty was doing well financially. We go on to describe, not quoting, the falsity in the rest of the publication.
So what I'm trying to do is just initially focus on the words of the publication. So the publication uses misled and affidavit. Is that correct in number 3?
That's correct. It uses those words. And we quoted only a portion of it. In connection with publication number four, we cut, pasted, and put one of the two-sided postcard in the pleading.
Okay, so that's that. I'm sorry, number four is that fanciful postcard.
That's correct.
Like the one that purports postcard from an island.
That purports to have been written by Mr. Motes.
Right. Okay. And the language in number four is misleading statements in an affidavit. Is that correct?
Yes.
Okay. That's the exact language of the publication.
Have made misleading statements in an affidavit are the words in that document. Yes, Your Honor.
Okay. So is your argument is that those words are the equivalent of lied and false?
Absolutely.
And that's why you say it's per se?
Absolutely.
Is that the logic of it?
That's the logic.
Okay.
And a review of this court's disbarment opinions will disclose readily that you have disbarred persons for lying on language that is the functional equivalent of that. There's a federal bankruptcy fraud statute that would attack a false affidavit with false language or misleading language. There's a state perjury statute that will do it. There's a definition of the term affidavit that does it. And Mr. Motes has no way to get any redress about what he was called and how he was marked except to have his day in court.
Let me direct your attention to publication number four. That has been characterized, I believe, by Mr. Graz as political satire. Is there a legal concept of political satire, and is that protected by the First Amendment?
I think the answer to that is no, Your Honor. There is a legal concept of political speech. It's clear that's the most highly protected kind of speech. Satire is a form of speech, but what is legally recognized is political speech. Political speech has constitutional protection unless the party who claims to have been defamed by it can establish an element of proof imposed on the pleading and proving process by Sullivan versus New York Times, which is that we have to prove, after pleading, that the publication was actually false. In this case, we have pled the publication, and we have pled the precise location at which the truth exists in a United States bankruptcy court file in the District of Nebraska. So in this case, we have said, you've accused us of a false affidavit. If you would have conducted a minimal investigation in a public record, you would have found your statements are false, and here's where the proof is.
I believe Mr. Graz also characterizes both publication three and four as being opinion. What is your response to that?
Our response to that is similar to the one I just gave, but not identical, Your Honor. Opinion is not protected speech. It can be political speech, and political speech is protected speech unless the element that I just described from New York Times versus Sullivan is satisfied. The fact that something is an opinion does not make it non-factual and non-defamatory if, in the context in which it is uttered, it can reasonably be mistaken as fact. And that's true of both of these publications.
Well, the Republican Party, the way I read their briefs is that context is critical, and a reader would understand this to be either hyperbole or whatever, satire. And with that publication four and the depiction of the island and the palm trees, that you have to read all that, and a reader would say, well, this is just typical political satire or hyperbole.
Yes, I know that's the Republican Party's position, sure. Your Honor, and I respect that it is. My response to that is that a great deal of the public believes a great deal. It was well into the second millennium when the Pope of the Catholic Church believed the earth was flat. There are people in this country who believe that taking some sort of over-the-counter medication is a cure for cancer. But there are rational people, not always highly educated and not always with master's degrees in political science, who think things through and don't get to that conclusion. The Republican Party is not entitled to the benefit of the doubt on that. It defamed this person by calling him a liar in an affidavit for all practical purposes, though it didn't use the word liar. And it's not entitled to get out of it because now it says, didn't we use a cute palm tree on the publication?
How important is the fact that the misleading statement is in an affidavit because an affidavit is a word of art, it's a special kind of piece of paper?
Your Honor, I think it's important because it makes your work in this case easy. If it weren't true that the allegation against Mr. Motes was that he made false statements in a court document and in an affidavit, I could not say to you that these are accusations of criminal misconduct. I can here. That, I think, makes your work easy. Thank you very much.
Thank you. Mr. Gross, good morning.
Good morning. May it please the Court. Your Honor, this Court has asked the parties to discuss the applicability of defamation per quam in the context of political speech as it pertains to certain publications, numbers 3 and 4 in the appellant's complaint. The appellant seeks to avoid the requirements associated with per quam claims by recharacterizing the publications in question in an attempt to transform the pleading into a claim for defamation per se. Specifically, the supplemental brief at page 1 alleges that the publications in question, quote, called him a perjurer, accusing him of a crime. The supplemental brief also alleges the publications accuse the appellant of making a, quote, false affidavit. Now, the fact that the appellant had to rewrite and embellish the alleged defamatory statements in his brief confirms that the complaint does not state a claim for defamation per se under Nebraska law. Neither the First Amendment nor Nebraska defamation law allow a candidate to rephrase or rewrite the language of an opponent's political brochure so that it constitutes an allegation of the commission of a crime, and then proceed to utilize the judiciary to prosecute a claim against the opponent for defamation per se. The actual words of the publication are critical. At page 32 of the supplemental brief, the appellant asserts, quote, he was called a crooked lawyer, end quote. Now, as the Court knows, no such words were used in these publications. But I think what's interesting is that even if they had been, the appellant still has not stated a claim for defamation per se. And I'd like to discuss briefly two cases that are not discussed in my brief. The first one is Harubi, H-R-U-B-Y versus Kalina, 228 Nebraska 713. In that case, this Court held that the words, and I will change the quote due to the audience this morning, you crooked blank you, and quote, you're crooked, were not actionable per se, and that the claim for slander based on these words should be dismissed since no special damages were alleged in the petition as required for a per quad claim. Furthermore, in a case involving an allegation of perjury in a sworn statement that was made coincidentally to Mr. Domina in his role as a special assistant attorney general, this Court expressly distinguished between misleading statements and perjury. In State v. Douglas, 217 Nebraska, at pages 218 to 219, this Court held that a sworn statement, quote, if literally true, does not constitute perjury, even if it is intentionally misleading and by negative implication, false. If the answer is literally true, the failure to volunteer more explicit information is not perjury, even though the answer may create a misleading impression, end quote. So it is clear then, Your Honors, that accusing one of a misleading affidavit is not defamation per se.
In Douglas, what were the facts of the misleading, purportedly misleading statement? In what context?
It was an impeachment trial, Your Honor.
Right. In what context was there a misleading utterance? Under oath?
The Attorney General of the State of Nebraska gave a sworn statement to Mr. Domina. Later, he was then was brought up as whether this was an impeachable offense, and the Court found that it was misleading, but that it wasn't perjury, and therefore it was not an impeachable offense. It is true that political speech is not automatically exempt from defamation claims, as the appellant asserts. However, in the area of defamation per quad, the applicable standard is particularly high and usually insurmountable. That's because of the fact that context is paramount in those cases, and the context is political speech. The appellate argues at page 16 of his brief that the court can simply rely on the malice element as protection for political speech. However, application of the malice element to claims involving public figures and the protection of political speech are not one and the same. Additional protection is afforded to political speech beyond the malice element. For example, the U.S. Supreme Court has previously held that accusing a national, religious, and political figure of incest is protected speech if it's in the form of political satire. Now, clearly, then, the breathing room that's provided by the First Amendment goes well beyond tropical postcards and statements opining that an affidavit was misleading. That is why courts have traditionally given extra scrutiny to complaints involving defamation in this context. Otherwise, the mere ability to continue to litigate
But there's some difference, counsel, isn't there, between sending out postcards in a political context and in a cartoon in Hustler magazine? I assume you're referring to the Flint case.
Yes, I am. And I wrote a paper in law school criticizing that decision. I thought it was outrageous, but it's the law.
But I mean, they said the crucial element is, right, is context.
Yeah, and I would argue that a postcard with tiki gods and tropical plants is also political satire, purporting to be sent from the Cayman Islands, but clearly marked as being a political brochure paid for by a political party.
The cases on which you rely for the general proposition of the breathing room in the political context, are any of those decided on the basis of a motion to dismiss, or were they further along?
Not that I'm aware of, at least not at the U.S. Supreme Court level. I could be wrong about that, but I'm not aware.
Right. And so too in Douglas, in the Nebraska jurisprudence.
Yes.
Because here we set re-argument, did we not, in part because of the standard, to discuss the standard applicable on a motion to dismiss at this stage of the proceedings.
Right, we argued the new standard in our original briefs and at oral argument, and we believe that the appellant's complaint does fail to state a claim for the reasons set forth in our original brief.
So it's my understanding that you're relying on N. Ray Douglas, that the word misleading does not equal false.
Yes, Your Honor, I think it's pretty clearly established by that case. The court looked at whether a misleading affidavit or a sworn statement in this case was perjury and concluded that they were two different things. That's why I said in my initial oral argument that as an attorney, I've seen misleading affidavits on a very regular basis, and the reason for that is the same reasoning of this court. An affidavit only has one side of the story. You may say 10 truthful things, but it may be misleading because you may leave out 9. But you're not required to put them in your affidavit. It may be misleading, but it's not false.
Plausible that a misleading affidavit could be a false affidavit and actionable, say it's perjury or something else?
Not if it was simply misleading and not false. And the reason for that is something that is misleading, I think, is inherently subjective. In order to be defamatory, it has to be objectively, provably false.
You're saying misleading, misleading a person in an affidavit could leave out the harmful facts or injurious facts and still not be lying.
Absolutely, and this court basically held that in the Douglas case. And as I was saying, courts have traditionally given extra scrutiny to complaints in this context. And the reason for that is if you allow a plaintiff to litigate, continue to litigate a meritless defamation claim, you're basically allowing them to punish someone for engaging in constitutionally protected activity. Here we are dealing simply with a stated opinion that the appellant made a misleading statement about an insurance company in an affidavit. More importantly, the appellant's claim is simply not actionable under Nebraska law. The complaint fails to set forth facts to explain the defamatory meaning of the words claimed to be actionable in publications 3 and 4, The complaint asserts claims as to publications 3 and 4 that cannot constitute defamation as a matter of law due to the protection of the First Amendment, and the complaint fails to specifically plead special damages, as in the Harubi case. Consequently, the complaint fails to state a claim that is plausible on its face, and the decision of the district court should be affirmed.
Let me ask you, if I could, about the significance of the misleading being in an affidavit, which is a special piece of paper.
Well, one comment that I would make is that there's not some special layer of protection surrounding people who have bar numbers after their name, simply because someone could be disciplined by the Supreme Court for doing something doesn't mean that that states a claim for defamation per se, so that a political candidate who happens to be a lawyer has this extra layer of protection around them that no one else has.
But instead of assessing this in terms of attorney discipline, because the plaintiff happens to be a lawyer, is that correct? But rather, is there a plausible crime by him? Is it plausibly actionable to have a misleading affidavit by...
Had publications 3 and 4 said what the appellee claims they said, such as false affidavit or liar, in a sworn statement, then you could conceivably have something that accuses someone of a criminal offense.
Your proposition is the word insulated shields it.
Yeah, the actual words of the publication have to be what the court looks at. The word was misleading. This court has already said that misleading is not perjury.
Thank you. Mr. Domino, I will give you 1 minute of rebuttal. A minute and a half of rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. May I briefly comment on State versus Douglas? There are three things about that case that are important to know, I think. First, at the time of that impeachment proceeding, the standard for conviction on articles of impeachment was the criminal standard. The Constitution was amended after that. So that was effectively a criminal case. Second, the vote was 4-3 in favor of impeachment, but it took 5 votes from this court. And third, you subsequently suspended Mr. Douglas from the practice of law for 4 years for those statements. Secondly, I would say this. Nebraska is a special place, not just because it's home, but 2/3 of our state government stands for election in nonpartisan contests, the legislature and the judiciary. The Republican Party was not a contestant and did not have a contestant in this election. Every other case cited by the Republican Party in support of this, its position, is one in which the alleged defamer was a contestant or aligned politically with a contestant in a partisan election. Our people chose to have a nonpartisan legislature. This undermines it. We're standing up for it. But let's look at the third branch of government. What if this attack is made on a judge standing for judicial retention and the canons of judicial conduct largely shut the judge's mouth anyway? But false statements that are malicious statements in a campaign that utterly mischaracterize a judge's position and do it by imputing to him an evil motive and maybe even corruption in office would be without redress and without a day in court. Mr. Motes needs to win this case, and Nebraska needs to have him win it. Thank you.
Thank you. That will take us to the